So we're going to be heading toward today entanglement scaling in many body systems. So not just like entanglement of a small number of qubits or spins, but like what happens when you have a macroscopic number? What can we say about the leading part of entanglement? And then tomorrow I may tell you a little bit about there's some interesting subleading parts that our people are investigating right now. Yeah, actually I forgot we had a little bit something from yesterday that I wanted to cover. So yesterday, let's review that really fast, actually. So yesterday we talked about that matrix product states, right? Remember those guys? These are a class of wave function in 1D, and we showed that generically you get exponentially decaying. Connected correlators. Connected just means there's some operators for which even when you take them two of them far apart, you're gonna have a non-zero expectation value for each individually. Like again, you know, density operator in a system that has a fixed overall number of particles is gonna be non-zero no matter where you put the density operator. I mean, in a uniform system. So we found that if you subtract off that background expectation value just to get the part that could be decaying, that this will go like with some correlation length. And the correlation length is actually a property. I mean, it's always true that the correlation length is a property of the wave function, but here we found an explicit, it's related to an explicit, you know, eigenvalue of this certain piece of the matrix product state. Kind of interesting because it's some like local piece. So it's just you take a piece of the wave function on a site for translation variant system, and you can just root off the asymptotic correlation length. So that's interesting. So that gives us an intuition that MPS are appropriate. For ground states of gap systems, 1D systems. Okay. And by the way, about tomorrow, I haven't totally set what I want to talk about tomorrow for the last lecture. And I could explain to you guys a bit about DMRG. Is there some interest there? So I think I only have to basically introduce one more concept that's not too hard. And I think I can explain the algorithm almost in like one picture. Basically, so maybe we can knock that out. And then I think I may just mention some stuff about these MIRA wave functions that Giffre has been developing over the last, you know, kind of 5, 10 years. So we could talk about that briefly. That connects to some stuff with entanglement today. Does that sound good? Okay. Just to give you guys a flavor of, so what you can do is hold on and think that we actually have a pretty amazing algorithm that's very efficient and nice that can just produce for you matrix product states from gapped Hamiltonian. So if you can take a 1D Hamiltonian, you know, any Hamiltonian in 1D, basically the short range, throw it into some code, out comes like a perfect matrix product state, ground state. So this is really nice. And even, as I mentioned yesterday, even for gapless systems, you can work harder and keep things on some finite size system or only ask for results out to some distance that will depend on, you know, sort of how big of a bond dimension your MPS has. And you can even get reasonable results for gapless systems. So we can do kind of everything in 1D with matrix product states pretty much. All right. So there's actually a theorem. So, you know, seeing this intuition that we know that, because remember, you know, gapped 1D systems, generically gap equals correlation length. Okay. So the idea is that roughly C is equal to 1 over delta. Okay. This idea that if you have a gap, the inverse of it gives you a correlation length, that these are like twins, right? And in some sense, it's sort of, you know, you can see the converse too. Like if you can disturb a system at some very long distance scales. So if you can take a system and you can set up some kind of coherent disturbance through the whole system that involves all, you know, all the degrees of freedom of the system, that means that you can generally, I mean, this just intuitively, you can produce gapless excitations that way. This is like what Goldstone modes are, right? You take some order and then you can make some small change in that order along the whole system. And all these ordered, say, spins are talking to each other. They're somehow rigidly fixed and feeling the effects of all the other ones in some sense. So you can set up some very long wavelength disturbance, which means you pay a very small energy, right? So that's the intuition about why these are related. If you can do something long wavelength, that drives down the gap and vice versa. You know, they're kind of connected, right? So that's the intuition. So this has actually been made rigorous. So I'll just mention really fast that there's a theorem by Hastings, and I don't think I talked about this yesterday, right? That basically made you prove that matrix product states are close to gapped ground states, right? I didn't mention this. Okay, this is actually a paper from 2007 called "An Area Law for 1D Systems," and we'll mention this theorem again. There's another side to the coin here that I'll mention a theorem by him again later today if we get to it. And it's actually from the same paper. It's just sort of two statements of the same work. But one statement is that in this idea about, we see that MPS basically behave the right way in terms of their correlation functions, you can take this intuition that they're appropriate ground states. And this can actually be proved that they really are appropriate in the sense of let's just say, for a local, there's some additional things you have to say to make it rigorous. But local meaning like operators only go out to some finite distance and just stop. And 1D Hamiltonian. So if we take that kind of Hamiltonian, we need a finite energy gap. And I believe in this paper he assumes unique ground state, though I think that can be relaxed. So the picture is that you have a ground state, a gap, and then excited states. And here saying you have a gap, this theorem is really discussing finite systems, but the idea is that this gap needs to be something that goes to a constant as you make L go to infinity. So really stays open in the thermodynamic limit. Then the idea is there is a matrix product state of bond dimension D. And there's some p greater than 0 that depends on things like the gap and this thing called the Lieb-Robinson velocity and some other properties of the Hamiltonian. So you can think of it as depending on the gap and depending on, say, the norm of the operators going into the Hamiltonian, right? So this includes overall scales. Like you might have a spin chain with a coupling J, and J may not be 1, J may be 10 or something. So you have to include all this in this number p. And this p is independent of D. Okay, such that if you take expectation values of local operators in the MPS and compare that to the exact answer, that they're close together. They're bounded by an amount that some C that depends on the, I keep writing a phi, that depends on O, the operator that you pick. So it just depends on, if you make this operator artificially very big, this bound has to be pushed up, right? If this operator has the number 100 in front of it or something, you have to include that in the bound. So that's just, that goes in there. But the important part is that there's D to the minus P. So as you make D, the bond dimension of the MPS, bigger, for all intents and purposes, the MPS just gets closer and closer and closer to the real wave function. And this has been proved. So when this is the situation, we really have a rigorous sense in which MPS are like the right type of wave function to describe these ground states. Okay, any questions about that? And apologies to Matt Hastings if I missed some aspect of the argument here, because this is my like translation of it from a lot of more mathematical writing. But I think the way it was stated in the paper was more on the level of that they're actually close as vectors in the Hilbert space, that the MPS is really close to the wave function. But that means that, if you measure operators, and this O is supposed to be some local operator. If you measure operators that are close. So this could just be some operator that has support on one site or on a few sites, that kind of thing. For gapless systems, right, it's different because, there you can get local properties to match. But then overall, the wave functions are actually quite different because at long distances, they really become, they become orthogonal in large systems because at long distances, the MPS loses coherence, if you will, at some distance. And the gapless system really has some kind of correlations that survive out to all distances in some power law fashion. Okay, so entanglement. Right? This gives us a different perspective on this idea that MPS are the right kind of wave function for a gap system. So we have the correlation length picture. So another picture of why MPS are the they're like the right form of ground states. Of gapped 1D Hamiltonians, okay. Another picture is that they have the right amount of entanglement, which by amount I actually mean scaling. And it's important to mention this alternate perspective, because this perspective is part of what's carrying this research forward into gapless systems, into 2D, and maybe in the near future, 3D systems, is that we people are thinking very hard about how much entanglement generically does a ground state or an excited state or a very high energy state have for various kinds of Hamiltonians and different dimensions, things like that. And then we're just trying to produce wave function ansatzes which have that kind of scaling of entanglement. So what's entanglement, right? So let's define that. How many of you guys have seen entanglement entropy as a concept before? Okay. So you guys all have seen that. So I probably shouldn't dwell then on too much on some elementary examples, but maybe I need to, just to be thorough. Let's just define it again really carefully. So So we take a wave function. You can make definitions for mixed states. Let's take a pure state wave function and divide it into regions A and B. Okay. And these regions don't have to be like the left half of the system and the right half of the system. It could be A is like every even site, B is every odd site. It could be something crazy like that. But just to start out with, let's just think of A as like all 1D as just like all the sites up to some point, and then B is all the ones to the right of that after that. So we're cutting, people talk about cutting the system, which really means you're just conceptually dividing lattice sites into two groups. Okay, that's all people mean by cutting. Okay, so we just come up with some partition of the system, and then the entanglement entropy, and this is called the von Neumann entanglement entropy. There's other extensions of this that you can define. Is just negative trace of rho A log rho A, and you can choose different bases for the log, but I'll just assume, you know, base E. And you can also equally well compute it by saying trace rho b, log rho b. So for pure states, it has this property that you can compute it with respect to either a or b, depending on which is more convenient. And rho a is the partial trace over b of rho, the full rho, which is the full density matrix, which is just this like psi psi outer product, OK? And similarly, rho B is just where you trace over A. So let's draw a picture of that. So the picture is, here is psi. Okay, so we're gonna be mostly doing pictures for today. Okay, and we take two copies of it. And then, so this would be psi dagger. And then all we do is we trace over region B. So here I'm saying this is B, this is A. So partial trace means we connect those lines in some case, we contract those lines. So we get an object that just has sites for region A, but two copies of them, right? Then this is rho A. Then we diagonalize that. I mean, in terms of how do you actually compute this, how do you actually compute the log of a matrix, right? You diagonalize it is the simplest way. So this is some UDagger, call this thing P, because these can be interpreted as probabilities. This is a diagonal matrix, P1, P2, and so on. And those add up to one, right? Because if the state is normalized, the trace of rho has to be one. And U. And so then if you do that calculation, then S is just sum over N minus PN log PN, right? So that's like the simplest way to think about computing this entanglement entropy. Yes. Yeah, that's right. So when I contracted all those lines, I just said, let's just, I mean, we could have written it as, yeah, actually, that's the only thing we can write. If there had been some lines connecting this half and that half, we could have lines surviving. We're going to see pictures like that in a minute. But here, this is the only most valid thing we can write, because I haven't assumed anything about the wave function, that it has any kind of structure or anything. No, it's just a blob just means it's some object with some indices. And so all I'm doing is I'm surrounding, think about extending these lines further out. And these further out, and then surrounding this with some circle that just says we're not going to ask what's inside that circle. That's generally right. And today we're going to be seeing that when there's more structure to the wave function, we can bound entanglement. That's going to be a lot of what we're doing in a minute. So you'll see examples where we can refrain from going this far, and we can keep things somewhat more factorized, and that'll give us actually some insight into scaling of entanglement. Here we are making no assumptions about the wave function. So here we just have to ask what kind of object did we get? And it's just the most, all we can say about it is it has eight indices. That's it. That's all we can say at this point. Okay, good question. Yep, any other questions about definition here? Okay, let's get some intuition for it. Let's compute it for a couple of examples really quickly and practice this definition. So example number one should be familiar to you guys. This is the singlet. And we can write it as psi AB, like that, okay? So this means that, well, let's say what is psi AB for this case? Okay, so that's psi AB for this example. And so rho A, which has indices A prime A, so here I'm suggestively labeling these spins as A and B because that's our bipartition, is cutting it in half. Region A is just the first spin, region B is the other one. This is just using that definition, sum over B. Okay, right? So, because here what I've done is I've just said, make the outer product of psi and psi, but here I'm working in this like spin basis, not writing kets. And then I'm saying trace, this is the partial trace over B, right? So I take any degree of freedom that's associated with B, I make it the same, that's the trace part, and sum, okay, over it. So we've gotten rid of, we said we don't care about what's happening in region B. That's what the physically what the partial trace is saying. We say we only want to know about what's going on in region A. And this can tell us everything we need to know about region A, as long as we don't ask questions about region B. Okay? So this means that this is just, if you stare at this, right, if you flip these indices, it becomes a matrix multiplication. So we can just write this as psi dagger A prime A. So it just means take this matrix and square it. And interpret it as well, with its transpose, and interpret that as the matrix for the as the density matrix. Okay, so we just say 0, 1 over root 2, 1 over root 2, and then make sure to take the transpose. define that. Okay. So then we said that the from that last formula, we say that the entanglement entropy is that you sum up all of these eigenvalues. Here we don't have to diagonalize it. It just comes out diagonal for us. First of all, what's the interpretation, by the way, of that density matrix? So that is the complete description of the physics of just the first spin. All right, so do you guys see what is that telling you about that physics? So you, if you interpret this as some classical ensemble, right, what do these one halves mean? Probabilities? Yeah, you can think of them as classical because it's diagonal. Okay, and so it's telling you physically what is the first spin's physics by itself like. Yeah, it's just flipping up and down 50-50 probability. If you interpret this, interestingly, if you interpret this as a finite temperature state, this is the infinite temperature wave, you know, ensemble. So it's actually telling you that this is started out as a zero temperature kind of ground state for these for the system. And once you cover up one of the spins, the other one goes to infinite temperature. So it's a funny picture that like entanglement equals temperature in some sense. And people are pushing on this idea quite hard right now. People are finding examples where you can take a pure state wave function, carve out some region of it, some small region relative to the whole system, and get finite temperature physics out, basically. So it's this whole interesting area of research that people are pursuing. Okay, so this is kind of cool, right? And people are actually using this as a computational trick even to do finite temperature simulations. They're just attaching little singlets to everything, and then you can simulate temperature from this as well. So now computing the entanglement, writing everything out carefully, we just plug in these eigenvalues into that sum, right? Sum over the p's with minus p log p. All right, and then we can combine these. We get negative log of a half, and that's log 2. So that should be a familiar result if you guys have seen entanglement before. Okay, so this is like the kind of, you know, fundamental unit of entanglement for qubits. It's like this is the most entangled that they can be, a pair of them can be. All right. So that's important. So one observation is that max entanglement means that rho is diagonal. Well, not diagonal, sorry. Rho has equal eigenvalues. And because rho has to trace to 1, that means that if rho is d by d, then you have to have 1 over d, 1 over d, 1 over d, like that, okay? That's an important takeaway. I mean, I haven't shown that, but you can easily check that by considering 3 by 3 or 4 by 4 and just plugging into this formula, okay? So that's the most entangled kind of density matrix you can end up with. Or highest entropy, which means entanglement, actually. All right, so one other example. Let's take the example where let's choose our psi AB matrix to be this, okay? So even more quantum fluctuations. So this is the state up, up, plus up, down, plus down, up, plus down, down. All right? So if we compute rho A, again, we can just say that psi, psi dagger. And we find that it's also equal to the same thing. So just, you can just check that. You just square that matrix. It turns out to be the same matrix, just that's special for this case. And then you can diagonalize it as okay, so this is like the U, P, U dagger. Here you actually have to diagonalize it before it just came out diagonal for free. So it's interesting, in some sense, this one came out telling us that the first spin by itself is classical, even though together the whole system is very quantum, like the most quantum. Here, the first spin came out very quantum in some sense, okay? So that tells us something about its relationship to the other spin. And so we see that if we compute the entanglement entropy of this one, we get 0, okay? Because log of 1 is 0. So what's going on? Do you guys see what is this state secretly? So even though it looks very messy, do you have a guess of like what is this state written in a different basis that reveals why it has no entanglement? Yeah. Let me write that really fast. So that's correct. So it's the idea is it's it's just the product state of the x eigenstate, you know, the up eigenstate for the sx operator. That's all it is. So secretly it's just a product state, and that's what so the point is entanglement is smarter than we might be, right? You can write down something that looks messy and entangled, and then entanglement, this calculation will reveal to you that it's actually not. Yeah, what was your question?
On the curl equation that you wrote on the top board,
mm-hmm.
we had already asked about the first part, but on the second part, is
yeah.
it clear why, if you hadn't written UPU dagger, would it be clear that you would indicate that the diagonal matrix was
Oh, just notation-wise? Yeah. No, that notation, that's a weakness of this notation, is that it can't tell you what's inside those blobs unless you come up with some additional personal notation on top of it. Sometimes people will draw diagonal matrices as diamonds. So it's just some people have various conventions that they use. Yeah, maybe it's because diamond and diagonal start with the same letter, or I don't know. But like, for instance, if you look at papers of Giffre Vidal from the early 2000s, he's done a lot of work on matrix product states, and there's a lot I'm not telling you about matrix product states. One is that there's all these different special gauges, and there's one called the canonical gauge, and that one involves putting matrices on the bonds as well as on the sites. And the nice thing about that is that you get this property, this left orthonormality and right orthonormality that I mentioned, you know, the other day. You get that relative to every single site of the system, so no matter which, actually relative to every bond. So no matter where you cut the system, it always has this left and right orthogonality coming from every direction. But you pay a price of having extra matrices. And these are diagonal, and he often draws them with diamonds in his papers. So. All right. Yeah, so okay, one other just interpretation thing I wanted to say is that in some sense, entanglement, what this is telling us is entanglement summarizes the amount of correlations, right? So when people talk about correlations, this is what entanglement is telling you. But it's really just an executive summary, right? There's more information about the correlations if you really examine pieces of the wave function, meaning if you really look at the density matrices, right? So here, you know, the one half and the one half separately are telling us something that the entanglement kind of brushes over, right? It summarizes the whole thing. So people are actually doing a lot of studies where they take more complicated systems than just two spin and a halves, and they cut the system and they examine that whole spectrum of the density matrix, and they call this the entanglement spectrum. And there's a lot that's been made of the entanglement spectrum. So for instance, in quantum Hall systems, you may have heard, we didn't cover these, but you may have heard that these systems can generically have gapless edge states running around. So they're gapped in the bulk, but at the edge, the gap closes and you have an interesting 1D gapless system always running around the system. And you can see properties of that 1D system by cutting the bulk, which is gapped, and looking at the spectrum of this density matrix, same definition. So somehow that mimics the spectrum of the edge. It's a very weird result that people are using. So just some stuff to mention that you guys can go and read about. All right. So now back to matrix product states. The question we want to ask is, how much entanglement do they have in general? How much can they carry, right? So you can think of the bonds as like pipes that are carrying entanglement, carrying correlations through the system. So how much can go? How much correlations can we build up in a matrix product state? So let's step back for a second from matrix product states and just talk about structured density matrices. Okay, structured is just a word I'm making up here. I don't know if that's the technical term. What I mean is density matrices, this actually connects back to that question from earlier, which was a good question because it relates to this, which is if the density matrix is just one blob, you can't say much about it. It's just the most general thing you can have. But what if it's not just a blob? Okay. So let's think about some row A tilde prime A tilde, where here A tilde means a collective index, A1, A2, A3, through AN. Okay, and let's think about each AJ as going from 1 to D. And then that means that A tilde runs from 1 up to D to the NA. So a lot of notation, okay. NA is the number of sites. All right, and let's even define this as A. So I'm gonna use that letter to mean both region A and its dimension, okay, kind of interchangeably. So when I use it as a number, it means the dimension of the Hilbert space of A. All right, I was kind of running out of good letters to use, so I just said, let's call that A. So now let's just, what I mean by structured is let's assume that row A has some actual form, some internal structure. And this structure is, let's take the simplest case, which is that there's some internal bond connecting the primed indices to the unprimed ones. And that bond has some size d. So as a picture, this looks like this. It looks like there's some internal structure that's just this bond with d values connecting A1 prime, A2 prime, AN prime over to A1, A2, AN. All right, that's rho. And let's assume D is less than A, which for practical cases, that's going to be what we want. Because the idea is this is coming from doing a partial trace on some tensor network. And the whole point of tensor networks is that the bonds, like the matrix sizes, tensor dimension sizes you encounter, D. Here I'm being pretty general, but you know, for an MPS, the whole strategy is we want D to be something we can manage, like 100, 200, maybe up to a few thousand, whereas the Hilbert space size can be vastly bigger than that. It's exponentially big, and sometimes you can even use MPS for infinite systems. So it could actually, A could be infinite, and yet D could be finite, and that's still okay. We can still describe the physics, which is kind of surprising, right? It all has to do with entanglement, actually. Any questions about what I'm assuming here and what I mean by the A's and all of this? So all I'm assuming is that there's some internal simplifying assumption about what's going on inside this density matrix. All right, so what we can see, this isn't the most rigorous argument, but I believe it can be made rigorous pretty easily, is that if you think of the VI A tilde part as a collection VI of vectors in the space A, right? So this is I vectors, each with dimension capital A, right? So just think of holding I fixed, then this is just a list of numbers, you know, indexed by this large collective index, right? So then what this is in the most general case, right, generally span of this collection, okay, span of the VIs, thought of as vectors, right, will span an A minus D dimensional space. So in the most general case, we can think of these VIs as being linearly independent, right? They may not be orthogonal or normalized or anything, but they're just, you know, D linearly independent guys labeled by I, okay? And so they just span some D-dimensional subspace of, I guess I should say D-dimensional space, right? That's right, D-dimensional space, okay? Some D-dimensional space within A, this Hilbert space. So therefore, the kernel or null space of this matrix, VI A tilde, because again, here we're thinking of this as like the row index, this is the column index. That must be A minus D. Dimensional, okay. So that's another way of just saying, I'm kind of restating the same thing from two sides. That's just saying that, you know, VI A tilde has rank D, all right? But then that means that row A also has rank D. So intuitively, this means that you can find A minus D orthogonal vectors to this space that you can bring and annihilate the VI matrix, the VI out, A tilde, VI A squiggle matrix, right? So you can say there's some vectors VI, if you have VI A tilde and you multiply by some W A tilde and sum over the A tilde, you get zero. And the point is that there are A minus D. There's a basis of A minus D of these. Okay, so they would annihilate the V, they would also annihilate rho, because rho is just V with some other stuff, okay, coming from the right and summing over the A index. Okay, any questions about that? So this is what we wanted, right? That rho has rank D, okay? So somehow just by having this internal structure, we can argue this. So that has consequences for the entanglement. All right, so we said that most entangled case was when rho is, if rho is the D by D matrix, it's when it's 1 over D, etc. Okay. But if rho only has if rho has some limited rank, right, then there's some D by D part here with where all the non-zero eigenvalues go, and then there's the rest, which is the part where there's the zeros, okay, if it has some limited rank. So we find that, you know, if we have a rank D density matrix, then the entropy of that guy has got to be less than or equal to log D. Okay? That's what we wanted. So we see that just having this internal structure limits the amount of entanglement entropy this thing can have. Okay? So somehow there's like a weak link that means there it can only be so have so much entropy, which means the system that produced this density matrix can only be so entangled. And that's it, okay? So we can generalize this by considering other kinds of structures of density matrices. So we could say, what if we have a case that's sent like this, where there's two lines connecting. One has size D1, range D1, one has range D2. Okay, so these lines can take, one can go between 1 and D1, one can go between 1 and D2. Then we can just think of this as a collective index in the middle. Of size d1 times d2. So the entropy is bounded by log of d1 times d2, which is the sum here. Okay. So this was our simple case with just one line. We can generalize it to say, what if we have two lines? Then the idea is that you just take the d's for each line and you add them. So if these d's were the same, it would be, right, if we had a case that was like, you know, some number of lines connecting, each one has d, then it's just, of the bound becomes, you know, number of lines that we cut times log d. Okay, and that's in the simpler case where they all have the same size. So we're gonna need this, and we're gonna make a lot of hay out of this result, right? We're gonna apply this to some different cases. And so in general, a strategy is if you have a more complicated structured density matrix, right? A strategy for figuring out, for bounding the entanglement by the tightest bound you can, this kind of thinking, is so what if you have a more complicated case, like this, some kind of funny structured density matrix? The strategy is you want to come up with some way of cutting the fewest lines that divide the A from the A prime indices, okay? So I mean, we could have cut and wandered through here and cut through there or something like that and said it divides. Because the reason this works, right, is that I can now, after I come up with this artificial division, I can now do the I can do this contraction, right? I can compute these contractions. And when I do, it equals, basically it reduces back to this case. Okay, I just absorb this into that blob, okay? And then I'm back to using this rule. Let's just say here this had size D, D, D. Okay, let's say all those had bond dimension D. Then I don't care, I can just absorb that in, and the least I can cut is 2, and I just get 2 log D. Okay, right? This one would have worked as well. If that D had been different, maybe I'd want to cut there, but either way, I can come up with the bound. All right, questions about this thinking? Okay, I mean, it's a bit abstract, but let's apply, we wanted to develop this as a tool to apply this now to matrix product states, right? Because they'll have this kind of structure when we trace over region B. And then we'll apply it at the end to a different kind of tensor network state, and tomorrow, hopefully, we'll apply it to Amira and see what we get, and it's pretty interesting. All right? Okay, so let's take our current favorite type of wave function, matrix product state. And let's say, okay, region A is going to be the left, B is going to be the right. You can do other bipartitions, but let's do this one. This is an important and common one to think about. This means that row A we're going to trace out the sites on the right. So we need 2 copies. And then we just trace like so. And then for this kind of cutting the density matrix argument, we're not going to need these lines because these are internal to region A. And we're not going to need any of this structure, so let's just contract lines that we can always, you know, imagine contracting lines that are internal to some region and just, you know, grouping everything together. So we can say that this ends up having a form like one blob here connecting to some blob that's the remains of B, connecting to another blob that has the lines for the A prime indices, right? So this is like A1, A2, A4. Actually, I usually put the primes up on the top. So that's what these are, right? And these are the same guys. So again, you know, what is a density matrix, right? It's everything we know, everything we need to compute properties of region A. That's what these are for. But so we see that now using our structured density matrix argument, we can divide this into 2 pieces. What's the least number of lines we can cut here? 1, right? Yep, pretty simple here. So it may have looked like 2 at first. You see 2 lines, but then you realize actually just 1, right? So just cut this thing off, and you only cut 1 line. So this means that S, this is the result we were after all of that. Okay, let's call it SA here, just to emphasize that this is for a certain type of bipartition. It's different if you did some funny bipartition where like A is every, you know, odd site and B is every even. You can get different results, but here it's just this left-right bipartition. Okay? So that may seem kind of limiting, like, you know, MPS don't have that much entanglement, but that turns out to be the right amount for gapped physics in 1D. Okay, so that same paper by Hastings that I mentioned, actually the real point of that paper was to prove this, okay, from the Hamiltonians. So this is just, we said, if we, you know, make this ansatz for a wave function, that's the most entanglement we can find, okay? And you know, we can pump it up by making D bigger, but we're not gonna get that much more entanglement by making D bigger, so we better be happy with that much, right? So really what Hastings was after was proving that this is enough, that if you take any gapped 1D Hamiltonian, you'll find this is all the entanglement you need. It only grows that way. So basically it's, again, it's consider, I'll just state it really sketchily, consider 1D gapped Hamiltonian. I think also, again, there's an assumption of a unique ground state, but can be relaxed, I believe. And it just, the statement is basically for a bipartition he may have considered other partitions, but I believe this is the main one, that SA is bounded by some constant independent of the system size. So it just tells you that that's all you need, right? Yeah, and this is actually pretty non-trivial because in general, well, let's see actually. So let's compare this to sort of what a random state would do. But first, let me tell you some terminology. By the way, people are after these kind of theorems now in 2D, but I believe we don't have one still. So there's a big investigation going on about what kind of entanglement scaling can we expect in 2D, because once we understand that, we can really we really know like what kind of variational wave functions we can work with, we can live with, right? And again, if you think back to like old days of the variational method, you know, it had kind of a bad name because you were basically making up wave functions based on some intuition, and then the criticism you would have is that people would say you get out what you put in. This is the problem with the variational method, right? So you put in some wave function that has certain kinds of correlations that you made by hand, and then you try to vary it by lowering the energy and tweaking some numbers, and you get back that same kind of correlations, that same kind of pattern. So you can't discover new phases that you didn't know existed, essentially. You can, but you'd have to get kind of lucky, something like this, right? So, I mean, that might be a bit of a harsh criticism, but that's the criticism. So this gives us a whole other approach to variational wave functions, which says that here you'll get back gapped 1D physics, but if that's what you're after, this is good enough and you're done. Like, you don't need other kinds of variational states for gapped systems in some sense. So that's pretty powerful. Okay, so this terminology, right, this kind of scaling, this S is less than log D, independent of N system size, is called boundary law scaling. That's, I think, the preferred name, and I'm hoping that will catch on. I think other people are hoping that will catch on, because the other name is called area law, which came originally from studying black hole thermodynamics, actually. Okay. So just be aware that area law is shorthand for boundary law, but area law only makes sense in 3D, and here we're talking in 1D, so it's really boundary law, okay? But it's a concept that spans multiple dimensions. You can apply it in different dimensions. And what do we mean is, what we mean is that basically, if you have an MPS and you cut it somewhere, that this cut, the S of this cut, you know, is less than log D. What if you cut it in two places? Here I'm using a shorthand for an MPS where I'm not, if two lines intersect, there's intended, there's a tensor there, but let's put them in just to be careful, okay? Just because I want you guys to see the forest, not the trees, right? So if we cut in two places, we can bound the entropy as 2 log D, okay? This is two cuts. So the idea is that the bound is, it's like S is bounded by the, or you could say that S grows as the some constant like A times the boundary of region A, okay? You could say, well, here it's a constant, right, in 1D. Okay, it's just the number of cuts. But in higher dimensions, we'll see that, you know, it's actually like the perimeter of some region that we cut. Or in 3D, it actually is an area of some surface that you cut. All right. Let's compare that to... Yeah, roughly. That's the intuition about boundary law type entanglement, is that you can think roughly as that there's processes happening here, and there's processes happening here. Processes, what I'm thinking of is virtual flips of spins or things like that. Like, you could think of it actually as the Majumdar-Ghosh state is a great example of this. Remember we had this, one of these ground states with this Majumdar-Ghosh J1, J2 chain? And now there's a bit of a funny, even odd effect here. But we, when we're talking about this, we're talking as a bound, you know, some kind of rough scaling. So we're not trying to care too much about whether we cut here or here. So let's just always cut where the singlets are. Then if you cut the system left and right here, you only feel the entanglement of just that local singlet. So it's exactly log 2. You cut here and you call this region A, and the rest is B. This is B, and this is also considered B. Then you get 2 log 2. Exactly, actually, and then. You should, but that's what's key. That's a great question, because in general you should, but we have exponentially decaying correlations. That's the key. This all kind of ties actually together. That's also another. This is pretty loose, but this is something else I think about entanglement, is that sometimes people are casting entanglement as a fancy quantity to talk about. It's a bit theoretical. Whereas, you know, good old correlation functions are, you know, tried and true way of thinking about kinetic matter. But on some level, they're pretty much linked. I mean, in some sense, entanglement is like part, in some level, it's the study of like generalized correlations, right? We're talking about correlations, but minus any particular operators. We're not saying, let's look at SZ, SZ correlators, and then SX, SX correlators. Let's just average over the operators and just talk about what is the general pattern of correlations. So it's actually very powerful for that reason. It sort of has all the power of correlation functions and more, because we're not going to accidentally miss some correlations that are secretly there just because we didn't know which two operators to measure. That's one way of thinking about it, right? So from that point of view, it's actually a very conventional kind of thing to study, but it's way more far-reaching, and it's sort of a safer thing to look at. So this is really, yeah, kind of should be your mental picture of area law correlations, right? There's a really nice paper by Andreas Loschly from a couple years ago, where he actually took a system where there were cuts and then did perturbation theory that sort of healed back over these cuts and could really see precisely where this boundary law or area law came from. And here it's pretty obvious in this Majumdar-Ghosh, as long as you cut on these strong bonds, you see that the entropy you get is really just the number of boundaries that you put down.
Takes into account that we don't have long distance correlations because we're connecting only the neighboring.
Yeah, great question. So it takes a little bit to build up this intuition. One thing you should not think, though, is don't think that these bonds, these rather small D-sized bonds connecting, are only carrying information from one site precisely to the next site. They're actually doing a bunch of different things. So there, you should think of this bond D. Think of this as like a pretty fat bond, because this could be many hundreds. You should think of it as being decomposed into some piece that's connecting these two, and also some piece that's connecting this guy over there. I mean, you can actually take that these two bonds and sort of pull out threads out of them, pretty literally, actually, if you really have the wave function figured out and you know how to write it exactly. Or you could take all of this and you can find there's some channel, if you will, of information that's going through here and just skipping on over past this site and continuing on and then connecting to here. So you really have, you're building out correlations to different distances in some kind of rainbow-like fashion. But then a finite D is telling you that at some point you stop, that you get to some distance and then you're not, things aren't really directly talking anymore to each other. I mean, I'm saying this kind of loosely, but you know, there's always some tiny tail of correlations left over, but it's decaying exponentially. So that's pretty much like a hard cut for all purposes. So that's kind of what this finite D business is about in an MPI. So it's just telling you that there's a lot of interesting physics out to some distance, and then it just ends. Another way of saying it is that we take a picture like this, which is very static, and there's very short range correlations, then we just sort of smear it out a little bit. We just do some local, we apply some local unitaries to this that kind of reintroduces some probability for the singlets to fluctuate on that bond. But if you could, say, pause to the wave function and all these quantum fluctuations, you would see Majumdar-Ghosh-like correlations, maybe out to further distances as well. You would also get some correlations like that. So we just locally smear this up a little bit. That's like the picture. Yeah, good question. Does that answer? Okay. I wanted to contrast this with, just mathematically really fast, what can happen when area law doesn't hold. So let's jump to the other extreme and ask how much entanglement can we have in general, right? Just what's the most that there can be for a given Hilbert space and a given arbitrary wave function? I think we can answer that pretty fast. Okay, so just in words, if we just take a maximally entangled wave function, I haven't said how we obtain a maximally entangled wave function, but let's just use simple counting to see how big its entanglement could be. Maximally entangled psi, then that's going to be one of these blobs in general. Let's not make any assumptions about it, right? And we'll have, you know, region A, region B, and then, you know, as before, rho will be where we trace out B. Okay, so then we see that rho is a, let's say it's a dA by dA matrix, where dA is some little d to the nA. I guess here I switch notation a little bit. I call that capital A before. But basically, this is the Hilbert space dimension of region A. Okay, and it's just little d to the nA. It's exponentially big, right? So maximally entangled psi, I didn't say how we obtain one. But what I mean is that let's say that it's the kind of thing where this rho has full rank somehow. Let's just assume we can find aside that this row is going to have full rank, so all the eigenvalues are non-zero, and actually all eigenvalues are the same. Okay, this is something like you make a bunch of singlets, but you connect them to like all distances or something. Like every spin in region A has a perfect partner in region B that's sort of connected over, right? So they're all, if we trace them out, each one is at infinite temperature, something like that. Okay. Then the maximum entropy of this maximally, this maximally entropic rho is just going to be log of dA, right? That's that thing where we just have 1 over dA, 1 over dA, 1 over dA, all down the diagonal when we diagonalize it, because it has to add up to 1. So if you go through and do the sum and flip 1 over dA and get the minus sign, all that, same reason you get log dA. And then all we do is plug in what is dA. So we just get log d to the nA, and we just get nA log little d. And the important part is this nA. So we see that S max is growing like the size. The word people usually attach to this is volume of region A. So people talk about this as the volume law. Again, it's a little bit of a weird name because it's 1D. So I mean, sometimes people think of volume as being like 3D. But actually, I guess that's a more general word than area is. So volume just means the number of sites. Okay. I guess you could call it the size law or something. All right. So actually, it turns out that that a random wave function will be volume law. This is interesting. And again, this comes back to this idea that entanglement can give rise to thermodynamics, because in some sense, you know, you can think of picking a random wave function out of the full Hilbert space and tracing over part of it as giving you like an infinite temperature state. So it's some way of thinking about like, you know, what does it mean for something to have like sort of infinite temperature? It's like random state in the Hilbert space. It's got all this kind of hidden information, but it's like highly non-local. And then you look at some piece and it's at infinite temperature. And so the picture that people often draw in talks, and it's pretty helpful, is Hilbert space is like this vast place. Okay. And the game that people are playing with matrix product states is that we start down here in some little corner, which is product states. Okay, where S is exactly 0 on every cut. It's just totally factorized. This is an MPS with D equals 1. Then, and this is also the realm of mean field theory. Mean field theory is often taught as a approximation to the Hamiltonian, where you say, let's take some interacting part of the Hamiltonian and chop it up into some one body kind of part. But you can also think of mean field theory, a different approach is just think of it as variational, doing a variational calculation in the space of product states, and you'll get similar results as doing this chopping up of the Hamiltonian kind of thing. So this is mean field theory, right? You know, out here is like the realm of exact diagonalization, where people take small systems and will just work in the full Hilbert space, okay? So exact diagonalization methods just mean working in the full Hilbert space without making any assumption on the wave function. So these scale exponentially in general for the reason that this is exponential, similar reason, okay? So then the idea is that matrix product states are carving out some region here. So these are matrix product states. And then there's other guys beyond. There's like the Mira wave function, which we'll mention tomorrow. So you can push further. You can't get all, you don't want to get all the way to here actually, but you can push a lot further, all right? So this is the idea, is like we're carving out Hilbert space. And then some of this part is sort of worthless. By the way, this is abstraction. This is just a figment of the Platonic mathematical world in some sense. We don't need to go there. It's just totally nuts. I mean, this is just something that came out of some way that we set up things as a product, the tensor product, but it's just nonsense in some level, okay? So this is really physics down here, even, you know, time evolution, stuff like that. So just because things here, to get this kind of states, I mean, there's so much coherence that any real system, things would decohere very fast. You couldn't prepare these kind of states. That's what I mean. Okay, so we're kind of out of time, but I'll start off tomorrow by just discussing what does area law mean in 2D, and we'll write down something analogous to a matrix product state in 2D that has similar kind of scaling but appropriate for the 2D area law. Okay, any questions? Sorry? What was I computing? Okay. Just saying that if you, going back, you know, we got this bound by us having some structure in the density matrix. Then I just said, let's remove all structure, meaning that we make no assumptions about the wave function at first, and we just ask what size does the density matrix have, right? Then we just said, let's imagine that we choose these numbers in here as some random numbers, actually, it turns out, is a fine way to do it. Yeah, I didn't constructively give you a way of obtaining such a full rate density matrix, but you know, let's just say it's believable that there is such a way. In fact, there's many more ways to do that than there are not. So any random psi will do, essentially. You trace it out, and in general, you'll find that most of the time, this will have full rank with sort of probability 1, basically, and or 0.9999. So, and then let's say, even let's have the case where all the eigenvalues are the same. And then you can just simply see that if you compute the entanglement, you diagonalize that, they're all the same, they're all non-zero, that means the entropy will be this, and it'll scale as a system size of A. That's what we showed. We can talk more about it after we break, okay? Any other questions for today? All right, thanks.